everyone. Thanks for joining us for another reading meeting with Mark and Molly. I'm Molly Ferrythorne. I'm a postdoctoral researcher at UW-Madison, working with my co-host for these conversations, the reading researcher, Mark Seidenberg, right there. And we really are hoping that together on working on this project and other projects that we can really, you know, target these issues that are surrounding connecting research and practice so that we really all can work towards our shared goal of improving literacy outcomes for more kids. And so our goal for today is to have a discussion with our guest, Dr. Nell Duke, about some of these very issues and kind of take questions from you in the audience as we go along. So please feel free to put those questions in the chat so I can do my best to insert them into the conversation as we go along. I'm now just gonna ask Nell to tell us a little bit about her and her work and how she's come to do all the things that she does before we dive into our conversation.
Oh, great. Thanks, Molly. So I appreciate the opportunity to be on the Mark and Molly show and to connect with all of you out there in the virtual space. So I'm Nell Duke. I'm a professor at the University of Michigan. I'm in two programs. One is called Literacy, Language, and Culture, which is inside our School of Education. And the other is called the Combined Program in Education and Psychology, which crosses over into our psychology department, which is in a different college within the university. My work focuses on early literacy development, birth through age 8, and I mostly these days work on literacy practice and literacy policy and its intersection with research. So I try to figure out how to take wonderful research, like the kinds of research on reading processes that Mark does, and research in instructional contexts, and figure out how to make that research work in a classroom setting and in policy. And to do that, I see it as a two-way street. So I spend a lot of time learning and listening to teachers, learning from teachers and reading coaches, literacy coaches, sometimes policymakers about what might be helpful. So that's what I do.
Fantastic.
Thank you for doing it.
Yeah. And really is a perfect fit for kind of the things we want to talk about. We're really glad you could join us because you are doing this kind of work yourself and have many areas of expertise. So we kind of wanted to dive into just a few of those today. And as we've kind of generally titled our topic today is how to build a daily schedule based on the science. But I thought we could maybe first talk just by defining our terms and what does that science word mean there? Because you come from, you know, some different university settings and schools and you've interfaced with the different camps maybe, and thinking about how people talk about science and is it different even amongst the researchers or the practitioners that are doing that translational work? So.
All right. So you thought you'd start with an easy question of what is science? Okay. Great. She's not going to start with a softball. So I think, you know, probably everybody out there in the virtual space together today would agree that science is systematic study. And when we automatically think of I think often of natural science, you also systematic study of sort of natural phenomena in the world. And then a branch underneath science is social science, right? And that's when the phenomena that we're interested in understanding have more to do with often with humans and with interaction with society. And there are so many different disciplines under social science, you know, developmental science and linguistics, and, you know, what you might think of as educational science falls under there, sociology, economics, right? So it's a pretty big umbrella. And then under social science, one of the areas of study, of course, is what is being called science of reading. And some of you have probably heard me say that I already think that term has come to be contested. And I know Mark feels that way as well, that it's sort of already getting used in a lot of different ways, some of which were not, you know, as hoped or intended. So the way I think of science of reading is that it's understanding reading through research. Through actual studies. So it's the scientific study of reading. And then within that, I think there are sub branches. So there's like science of basic reading processes. And that's really important. I mean, that that work that happens in lab, in small scale studies and one-on-one, if you don't have that, you're going to be flying blind in the next part of, you know, the science of reading in my mind, which is really the science of reading instruction. So the kinds of studies where we might like randomly assign large numbers of kids to this approach to teaching phonemic awareness or this approach to teaching phonemic awareness, and we see which one works better, right? That's like the science of reading instruction. And then there's, I think Mark and Molly agree, maybe a somewhat less well-developed, but sort of area of science of reading, which is like the science of implementation or implementation science work around reading. So, understanding how things get taken up, interventions get taken up in different contexts, understanding issues of equity and access as related to the implementation of specific phenomena and so forth. So for me, all that falls under that umbrella of science of reading, but I think it's at its heart, and I think it's the same for Mark and Molly, what we think as scientists is that when you're faced with a question or a problem of practice or a dilemma, your job is to figure out what the scientific research offers us in terms of how to address that dilemma, that problem of practice, that question. And then to, interpret and understand that as well through the lens of teaching and learning. Does that make sense?
I think we should write that down. I mean, that was really, I think that was really great. Really, honestly. Of course, the other angle is what's the quality of the science, right? I mean, for me, there's a lot of research that's done, and I have to use my critical sensibility to say, well, is this true? Was this done in a reasonable way? Do the conclusions follow the data? How does it fit with other stuff? And at some point, I think we do owe people a little bit more discussion about how you actually weigh various one, how you or I, how any of us would weigh the findings, because, I think a lot of people have the idea that you can just kind of pick out a study that you like and you go, well, the study showed. but there's a lot of studies out there. They aren't all equally good. And indeed, there's so much research, one should be able to put together things and weigh the body of evidence to come up with some reasonable conclusions. So it's a little bit more like, it's not quite so black and white as, well, just do a test, see which one of these programs is best, and then we'll have it settled. It's more of a converging evidence from several sources kind of thing. Were you going to say something, Molly?
Oh yeah, just that even if there was a great study that we thought was like fabulous, that still wouldn't be a thing that we'd be like, great, check, we're done. We've done one study that was designed, perfectly, and this is how we can go off and be in the world.
Maybe this is like a secret, like the secret handshake that we shouldn't be sharing, but if the study is really good and it really is well done and fits with various other things, eventually you're going to come to the limits of the study, the things that it didn't include, the other issues that it raises. So it's going to actually open other doors about which less is known, So so even when the studies
now
are really
implementation,
or for example, the huge step
of
towards
the real
implementation.
World. Yeah.
Yeah, so, that's so important, the point that you're making about, the way that we do science is really around the weight of the evidence. So it's kind of this slow process where you get a study and then another study and another study and you piece them together and that helps you figure this much out, but then that raises another question. And I think it can be very frustrating for some of the, teachers and others I work with, where they're, faced with making these difficult daily decisions about how to allocate time or which curriculum to use or, how to teach something. And, science just seems sort of so slow and plodding, in the face of those demands as a teacher. But at the same time, what it means is that, we can have more confidence in the conclusions that we do draw when we draw them.
Yeah.
I think it unfortunately also maybe comes across as wishy-washy of like, we can't make up our minds in the scientific community. Like, we're waffling on things. We aren't going to give you a clear answer. So there must not, maybe you don't actually know the correct thing for me to do, which is true. We might not, because we don't have that, like you're saying, that preponderance of evidence that makes us feel confident in making a suggestion.
In some areas.
Right.
I will say that one tool I really love that I think can be accessible to lots of folks joining us today is the meta-analysis. It's not perfect. No methodology is perfect, but meta-analyses can be so useful because they take a whole bunch of studies and they basically treat each study as a data point. And then they, you know, we carry out statistical analyses on those. And so if there's an area you're wondering about where you're feeling like, I really, really want to know what the research says about morphology instruction, or I really want to know what the state of the research is on, you know, factors that improve school attendance or something. If you go into Google Scholar and you type the word meta-analysis and then type the topic that you're interested in, you may be lucky and find a few meta-analyses, and those are, you know, going to be very useful tools for you because they're actually pulling together a whole lot of studies. Again, not perfect, but a technique you might want to try if you're pondering a particular area of study.
Yeah, this is perfect. So I agree that people should look at these meta-analyses, and some of them are really cut to the chase. I mean, they're really, really, really helpful. The not perfect part is the real, really true, because the meta-analyses look at the results of a large number of studies, and they're only as good as the studies that went into the meta-analysis. And often the studies that went in are not equally good. The other problem that people in statistics have with meta-analyses is what's called the file drawer problem, which is there are a lot of studies that fail to show effects of things that don't get published. And the meta-analysis is only based on the findings that are out there, which might show that one thing worked better than another. That's great. But someone might have done another study which showed something that was important, they were looking at didn't have an effect. And by the standards of the field, until recently, those studies were very hard to publish. So in that way, the studies that go into the meta-analysis might not represent everything. That said, sure, it's a fine source of information. Everybody has to keep their eyes open. And it certainly can give you an orientation to a lot of the research that's been done on a topic that you're trying to figure out. Absolutely. It's just, you know, it's like other things. It's a tool.
There's limitations. Yeah.
Yeah.
We have I just want to mention a book. It's now in its third edition. It's called Literacy Research Methodologies. And it just takes different methodologies that are applied in literacy research and everything from, we have a chapter on neuroimaging, a chapter on ethnography, you know, a chapter on experimental, quasi-experimental regression discontinuity designs. You know, it's a wide ranging chapter on critical race theory. So it's quite a wide array of methods that we address in the book, my co-editor Marla Millette and I. And with each methodology, we just try to explain like what is this methodology? What can you learn from it? And then by extension, what can you not learn, right? Like every methodology is limited. So what can you not learn? And then what are the markers of quality? And that issue that Mark just raised is one that comes up, as I recall, in the meta-analysis chapter is, you know, how do you know that the researchers have looked for publication bias and have considered publication bias when they've been, you know, doing their meta-analysis? So that might be a useful tool for those of you who might want to, you know, be digging into individual studies and trying to understand their worth or what they have to offer.
So from this moment forward, I'm going to remember that Nell has probably done something highly relevant on this point that I'm not remembering. So
just thinking, you've done everything.
My question is, so that sounds like a book that every prospective teacher could benefit from, because maybe they would find out a little bit more about how to, you know, how to digest some study that comes along that seems like it calls into support something or calls into question something. How do you weigh that? And so on. I guess it leads into the question of, you know, people thinking that teachers, again, I am not trying to focus on teachers as the locus of our literacy problems. I am just trying to think of, as the people who are on the front line, what kinds of information and tools could they use? And when it comes to this kind of research, there's the question of what's the level at which people really need or should be engaged, and how to get onto the what the on-ramp is. I mean, I'd love to hear what you think about this, because it's a tough thing to just sort of dip into. After all, we all know background knowledge about a topic influences your ability to understand a text. Well, that applies to reading research. So what are your thoughts about what people need to know, what they don't need to know, what the responsibility of the researchers are to kind of communicating these things? Obviously, you spend a lot of time trying to do this yourself. And where in the kind of teacher's experience or training or professional development would it be most useful to get this stuff, if at all?
So that's a great question, I think, Mark. And I share your view that for teachers to have a basic understanding of research, different kinds of research, what we can learn from research, what we can't, you know, how research operates, how they can do their own forms of research in the classroom. Of course, it's different, but action research or, you know, teacher research, it can be a really important tool in teachers' own classrooms. And I think that's very important. And what we, a sort of subset of that feels really important to me is what's sometimes called data literacy. But, you know, really making sure that teachers understand the assessments that they're in many cases mandated to use. Or, you know, in some districts I work with, I say, can you just, you know, give me a list of the assessments you're currently using in early literacy? And, you know, three pages later, we get to the end of their list. You know, so many different assessments that have very different underlying logics, different types of assessment, criterion reference, norm reference, you know, assessments that have been validated, assessments that haven't, some that are meant to be formal, some that are meant to be informal, and kind of all in this chicken soup of you know, assessments. And so there's a particular need for knowledge in that. And the umbrella that we would call that on is data literacy, or some people say assessment literacy. So I agree that that's really important. And there are national organizations and state organizations that have tried to articulate standards for what we think that teachers should know around those areas. But it hits a dilemma that won't surprise Mark or Molly, which is that I've argued in writing that I have reason to believe from research that has been done that a first grade teacher with 25, a first group of 25 first graders, that job is as complex. It requires as much an array of content knowledge and practice knowledge, and skill and complexity as being an emergency room physician, maybe more, because at least the emergency room physician gets to go to one patient at a time, you know, in a way that teachers, you know, often don't. And so what I've argued is that these professions are probably about parallel in complexity and in the knowledge required, but historically they've gone out in very different directions, so that the emergency room physician gets, you know, 4 years of undergrad that was probably, you know, fairly science heavy. And then they get their 4 years of med school, and then they get 4 years of residency. And then often they actually go on for a post-residency specialty, you know, for another 1 to 3 years, depending. And teachers in the US at most get about 2 years of coursework in their four-year undergraduate preparation program. And I say at most, because many of you are probably aware that there are emergency credentials and alternative credentials and all sorts of things that may result in teachers getting one summer of experience before they're alone in classrooms with children. So not everyone on this call may believe that or agree with my analogy, but if you think that that's true, then you start to imagine how hard it is to figure out what you're going to put in those 2 years. You know, you know everything from basic human development, you need data literacy. I've got a ton I need my pre-service teachers to know just about English orthography. And that takes a while to get them up to speed on that. And then I have all these other aspects of content knowledge I need to cover and so on. So, I think it just, an answer to your question in part, Mark, is yes, I think that's really important. And I think we probably won't do justice to it in the current teacher preparation system without also making that a focus of ongoing support. So the many very important people out in the audience who are literacy coaches or reading specialists or who design professional development, professional learning opportunities for practicing teachers, you know, you have a really important role to play in building on and extending what we're able to teach about data literacy in undergrad so that teachers can continue, you know, to learn and develop in that area, which honestly, we'd need them to do anyway, because if you think about, you know, a practicing physician, it's not like once they
maybe are- we learn something new.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they just keep treating, you know, cancer the same way that people were treating it when they graduated, right? Like they're-
right. No, I'm thinking that teaching reading is like treating cancer. Okay, can I ask you about this? So you raised several really, really crucial issues I didn't want to let go by. One is the issue about assessment. So, and also, I mean, my understanding is the teachers are getting tons of information about how their kids are doing in a variety of forms. Some of them are formal assessments, you know, that are widely used, and some of them are tied to particular curricula and so on. And the impression I get from talking with various teachers and groups and so on is, they're just awash with feedback and data. I mean, it's really, especially if you're using software, I mean, you could collect tons of data on how every one of your kids is doing every time they log on to whatever they're doing, especially now during the, you know, Zoom remote learning era. And then the company that, you know, whoever's, so then they collect a ton of data and there's the question of how much is this actually useful? How can anyone understand what's going on here? It is possible to have so much data you can't really conclude very much from it. So there's the issue of making the data relevant and also being able to assess, look, the kid's been given an assessment of their vocabulary or something, or their ability to comprehend in some way. What does the result of that test mean? And who is that test appropriate for? How much can you conclude from that test? I do think some additional sophistication about, well, how did they build these tests anyway? And, you know, so giving, having somewhere along the way, the ability to gain some critical thinking skills about assessment is, I mean, I know teachers develop it on their own, but having some additional stuff about what went into those things and what you can conclude from these data and so on, I think would be really helpful. But the other thing that is really crucial is, if there were unlimited amounts of time, then teachers could go to school for as long as, oh, you know, brain surgeons.
Right.
And they'd be, you know, no one would pay for it, of course, and it would be expensive. And it's not clear any school district would, you know, hire the person. I guess my question is, do you think a wholesale change in teacher education and teacher support, in service support, is required to cover what we need to cover, what needs to be covered better than we have been? Or are you working within the current system to try to kind of, well, pack it in, you know, do it efficiently while they're pre-service and then add more as you go along in service, I assume giving people incentives for, you know, continuing, but how much of a change do we need? What's realistic here?
I mean, another great question. So I think it's one of those both ends that we both want to make much better use of the time we do have with our teacher candidates. I think we can all agree that we have teacher preparation programs teaching things that are out of date, inaccurate, or just not the highest priority, right? So we could do better with the time that we have. In my point of view, I'd like to see a more developmental understanding of an approach to teacher preparation than we see a lot of times. So, for example, the way that we're doing it at my university, at University of Michigan, in our undergraduate is I get the interns, we call them interns, or are people who are in the teacher preparation program, I get them first, for the literacy sequence. And I just have them work one-on-one with first graders during my class session. So I teach some, and then for part of my class session, I hold my class not at a university, I hold it in an elementary school. So in the elementary school, during part of the class, they work one-on-one with a first grader. They administer an assessment 1 week, and then the next week, they design and teach a lesson based on the results of that assessment. Then they administer a new assessment, and the next week, so they're going through that assessment instruction cycle over and over again with just one kid. Then in the next course, which I don't teach, at that point, they're moving into working in small groups. And then following that, they eventually get to the whole class. So the idea is, you know, kind of our developmental hypothesis, and you might have a different one, but ours is that, you know, learning to teach one child to read and then how to manage a group of children and then to manage a larger group of children, that that's sort of one way to think about the sequence. I know some people out there have policy expertise or have policy influence. So I would like to say that just having the opportunity to, you know, lobby if you can for additional required credits in literacy is something I would recommend. Until recently in Michigan, we had 2 courses on literacy that were required. So you could graduate with your elementary teacher certification and you've taken 2 courses on all of the teaching of literacy. So we've been lucky to be able to double that to 4 by administrative rule. And then there's a group in the state now led by someone named Susan Ward Schmidt, who is trying to put that like more into law so that it wouldn't be at the whim, you know, of a decision makers, whether we'd have 4 courses, it would be in law. So 4 courses, it's still not enough. I mean, it's clearly not enough. And if any of you doubt me, sit down with 15 class sessions for 4 courses and figure out how you divide out everything that teachers need to learn. And I think you'll quickly acknowledge it's not enough, but it's twice as good as having 2, right? So it's a great improvement. So lobbying for more coursework in literacy. And then what we've also done in Michigan is we've pushed to narrow the grade bands. So the way the grade bands were before, when you got certified, it was kindergarten through 8th grade self-contained. That's really a lot, right? To prepare someone to teach 7th graders and to prepare them to teach kindergartners all at the same time in 2 courses, right? That's silly. So now our new grade bands, we have a pre-kindergarten through grade 3 band. And we have a different band for grades 3 through 6. And so that's a really helpful tool for us as well. So those are 2 things I would suggest lobbying for in your states if you don't already have the relatively narrow grade bands and if you don't already have at least 4 courses, which again isn't enough. So I think it's making the most of, you know, to summarize, it's making the most of the time we do have, making sure it's tightly aligned with research, it's up to date, it has some kind of developmental idea about how teachers progress as teachers. And then it's also pushing, you know, for more credits for narrower grade bands. And then I hope eventually moving into something where it's really more years, like at University of Michigan, our Dean Elizabeth Moji has led an effort to develop a teaching school, like a teaching hospital. Mm-hmm. In Detroit. It's a Mary Grove P20 campus. And so how that will work is that after someone's been through our undergraduate teacher preparation, they stay on, like it's a teaching hospital sort of idea where they're learning like residents do, essentially. They're learning, mm-hmm. developing, honing their ability to teach for several years, and then they go out to elsewhere in the district or elsewhere in the world as teachers. The problem there, Mark already pointed to, which is a money problem, right? It's like, who's going to pay for that? And how, you know, that's where that becomes challenging. But that's the model that the school of education.
So one thing I take away from one thing is that your program now seems to emphasize a lot more what is the term for it? It's practice teaching. I mean, it's teaching, it's trying things out with kids under supervision and then with small groups and so on. Historically, there used to be more of that, but then it got cut out a lot of places for budgetary reasons and so on. Or it's, that strikes me right there as something that's different from happens in a lot of programs. The emphasis on far more practice teaching with real kids with supervision, and which seems crucial. Is that an everyday part of most programs? That's not my impression.
Yes.
And
so
why not? And again, it takes time and money and resources, I'm sure, to mount, but it seems so crucial.
Yeah, I agree. You're right. You're pointing to practice-based teacher education is the, you know, terminology for that. And, you know, yeah, it's all over the map. So some programs, people will go all the way through before they, they're basically get to student teaching before they're spending a significant amount of time in classrooms. And other programs, they're in, you know, in our program, they're in classrooms from, I think it's the second week of our program, you know. So there is a lot of variation here. This is another area where the people on this call who are involved in policy, where you could have some influence. States often have policies for how many hours of clinical experience are required in order to be certified as an elementary teacher or to be certified like as a reading specialist. And so you might want to look at how many hours of clinical practice is required or are required in your state and see if that's something that you think you want, you know, to push on. I mean, I don't want to make it seem like I think this is an easy situation. We have teacher shortages in many places in this country. So on the one hand, we desperately need teachers. And on the other hand, we're talking about making becoming a teacher much more onerous. So that feels in direct contradiction. And I don't want to sort of not say that out loud. But I think those are, you know, depending on your context, something that you could think about.
Yeah, I mean, it is a problem. It historically has been a problem. If you raise the bar on training and education and so on, invariably, you know, there have to be alternative paths to certification because you have to be able to mount a program. However, you know, so the expense issue, I think, is both a problem, but could also be an incentive for people to go into the field. If, for example, some of the philanthropists who are very interested in education realized that we would be able to have, again, I don't mean to imply that people who are in the field now are not doing an adequate job or that they have not got adequate skills. We are talking though about, well, how can we ensure that more people have really great skills and can be successful the way they want. Well, how about, not to name anybody in particular, but there are a number of how about some philanthropy to really subsidize people's education, the costs of people who go into elementary education, for example, and in particular, the extra year or whatever that would happen if in a program, for example, like the one that you're doing essentially an internship year, you know, afterwards. It seemed to me if someone knew that they would be able to get really outstanding training, that it would have been supervised, they've gotten feedback, they've gotten the academic background in, you know, research and how to think critically about, you know, how kids are assessed and how the system works for different groups and so on. It takes a bit more time. And it's going to be a challenging program, but the payoff would be huge if their educations were subsidized. Their incentive for going into this program is you're not going to graduate in debt. You are not going to graduate in debt. And moreover, you're going to be well prepared for a job and you will be an attractive candidate for positions. And moreover, you're going to be able to succeed. So I really would like to see, I mean, I don't know where else the money comes from, but I
sounds like you've got a retirement project, Mark.
Oh no, Mark can't retire. That is not an option. Not an option, Nellie. No.
But don't you think this is true, right? You've got to give people incentives to go into programs that are going to take longer and be more expensive, even if they're better. And we're saying there isn't enough time the way it's being set up now. We do have some ideas about how things could be improved. And that there are places where people are working on implementing some of these ideas. Great. What if we also made sure that the people who graduated from these programs were debt-free?
Well, yeah, and wouldn't it also go to showing that we value our teachers, which is another problem that I know we've talked privately with Nell about, just the feeling of teachers being undervalued and underappreciated in our society.
Well, maybe someone will hear this kind of broadcast and say, you know, that's money that's well spent, as opposed to certain other kinds of projects people have tried. Yeah. It's better than building buildings.
Well, I appreciate everything you're saying. And yeah, if anyone on the call is a billionaire or knows a billionaire, we have good ideas for those billionaires. Probably some other ones we haven't talked about too, but absolutely. I didn't want to leave. I know we're eager probably to get to the topic of building a daily schedule, but I didn't want to leave this topic without also talking about how important it is that we diversify our teaching force. You know, our teaching force in the U.S. does not reflect the demographics of our students, and there's growing research that really points to how problematic that is for children. So that's a really important initiative as well, and I'd love to shout out the Center for Black Educator Development, led by Sharif El-Mekki, as, I mean, one of many, but a very important organization working to diversify, create a pipeline of teachers of color, particularly Black educators, into our profession. And so that's another thing that if you're looking for policy, you know, areas to work on, that's another one that would really benefit our profession. But let me stop talking about that, so pivot to building a daily schedule.
Hey, these are really, really important issues, and I'm really glad we've spent this time on this. And if money is the only obstacle here, we should be able to overcome that. We've promised people that we would talk about using the science of reading, you know, so we're all agreed here. We think the term science of reading, the scientists didn't invent that one. And we just think it's research on reading that comes from these various disciplines, and it gets at these various issues about how it works and how it's learned and so on. Okay, there's a body of research out there. You know, at the bleeding edge, there are issues that are still being studied and are not. It's always going to be that way. If the science is like energetic and making progress, there's always going to be new things. But we know quite a lot, and the idea is there's some really basic stuff that we could implement. I guess if we're going to talk about how to make use of research through the day. What does that mean? Just clarify for me what that means. And also, are we going to talk about it in terms of a teacher who's in a particular setting where they happen to have a particular curriculum to use, or where there's a mandate from the central office that they take a particular approach this year, or other kinds of real world constraints like that? How are we going to get this discussion off the ground? Because I'm not trying, does it sound negative? I'm just trying to figure out.
No, it's complex. I think you're absolutely right. Maybe we should start with the biggest possible picture and then work our way in and eventually get to specific curriculum mandates. I mean, think of the biggest possible picture, you know, a school day has a certain number of hours. And I've learned in the last couple of years, I wasn't aware of this, how much school districts vary in how long that day is. Mm-hmm. So right off the bat, you know, looking at that start time and that end time in the day, and looking at whether your district is on the low side of that, and whether the first thing you want to do is be, you know, trying to push for a longer day, because I'm, again, amazed at the variation from district to district and state to state and how much time kids are even spending in school. And then within that, I guess the next big picture is sort of, you know, who's making that schedule. So, some of you have probably heard of platooning or departmentalizing, which is where young children move from subject to subject the way that they might in middle or high school. So there might have one teacher for math and science and a different teacher for literacy and social studies, and they kind of rotate around. That's my impression is that's an increasing trend in elementary education. So there has been some research on that, not as much as I'm sure we'd like to see, but there is a there's actually a researcher, an economist, Roland Fryer, who did a randomized controlled trial on this, which is just like mind-boggling to me how he pulled this off. But he, within a very large school district, Houston schools, randomly assigned schools to either departmentalize in K-5 or for kids to have the same teacher the whole day. And he did this pretty rigorously in that for the schools that were departmentalizing, the principals had to submit a plan, and he'd read the plan to make sure that it, he had the Z scores of teachers, like that's a statistic, like sort of like how much value you add as a teacher in a given year. And he had those so he could make sure that like the principal's plan had the teacher who was the best at English language arts teaching have English language arts and not have math and science. You know what I mean? So they were pretty rigorous plans. And what he found was that there was a small negative impact of departmentalizing. So, and that consistent, oh, go ahead.
No, go ahead, sorry.
I was just gonna say, it's, that's consistent with not all, but most of the research so far. We could certainly talk about why we think that that's the case. But anyway, so that suggests to me that when you're based on the science we have to date, when you're building a daily schedule, what you want to do is have the same teacher teaching all of the major domains. You don't want to be building a daily schedule that chops up the day and has different teachers doing those different domains. So I've gotten that far. I'm going to let Mark get a word in edgewise before I go any further. Sorry.
I love your words. I just wanted to ask, how did platooning come about and departmentalizing? And what is this one of these things that's like an experiment that's just being done on kids rather than, you know, I mean, as a researcher, I'd say, well, hey, there's an idea. Maybe we could try it out on a moderate scale. We could see if it really is effective. We could do the kind of Roland Fryer study, but, you know, maybe not on 100,000 kids, maybe on a smaller group and see whether it's really solid before we roll it out on a on a broader basis. But in education, it's like you try out the idea and then you get the data later about whether it's effective. And in fact, you know, I said this in my book, it's like you're doing the experiment on the kids and that's not right. So how, without again having to name names or anything, someone suggested, well, this makes sense. It would make the best use of our resources. We'd have the best teachers teaching the relevant, the things that they're best at. And the kids would have different, I mean, I'm sure someone could make a list of all the benefits to this process. However, is it effective? Does it work? Is it better than what other approaches? So was it kind of like, let's try this? I mean, what is this? How do these ideas come into existence? And then we have to take many years and do a lot of very difficult studies to track down, they don't actually work that well.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great question, Mark. And I think you take it up, you know, very clearly in your book. And I don't know the origins of this particular idea. I do, the arguments you mentioned come up, though. A big one that comes up is teacher prep time, right? It's just so, compared to other industrialized nations and some of the higher performing school districts, our teachers get much, much less planning time in the US. Yeah. They get much, much less time to plan. And so, you know, there are various ways to tackle that problem. We could probably have a whole conversation just on that. But anyway, I think part of the rationale for this platooning or departmentalization is to cut by half the amount of planning time that a typical teacher would have to do. It just turns out that the benefit of that doesn't seem to outweigh other things like, I'm guessing, relationship building opportunities for integration and so on. But I think the larger question you're asking, Mark, is, you know, why does education keep chasing the latest shiny object? Why do we try to jump forward toward the latest trend or new idea instead of waiting until there's been some research on it and then decide? I don't, you know, it's some combination of desperation, honestly, because there's so many ways in which our school system is problematic. I just hit on one with teacher planning time. So that right there, but there are so many, right? So I think partly it's desperation. I think it's partly, now I'm going to forgive my researchery word here, but it's epistemological, meaning it's where do you think knowledge comes from? So if you think that knowledge comes from an idea that gets carefully curated and tested and then tested in a broader way and then tested again, and that's sort of how you progress, that's my epistemology. If that's what you think, then you probably wouldn't chase the latest shiny object, right? You wouldn't approach schooling that way. But there are lots of people in education who have a different epistemology. They have a different idea about how knowledge comes from or where it works, where they, you know, think that it's sort of like new ideas, you know, or just, you know, being on the cutting edge or innovating, and without a lot of concern about making sure that those innovations or their new ideas and so forth have been, you know, sort of carefully tested and curated. And we see it in curriculum all the time where people want this new curriculum that hasn't been tested and researched. And I think, but why didn't you want one of these other ones that have been tested and researched and shown to be effective, but you know, they're older. Sometimes yeah. They look older, you know, and then you're kind of up against, if they are out of date, you know, they're not aligned to the science. It's like, by the time we have a curriculum that's aligned to the science has progressed, you know, by the time we test yeah. The science has progressed. So, you know, I think there are reasons, but I think that, the general point of the point I think that you're making that's so important, Mark, is how cautious we need to be in chasing the latest shiny object.
Yeah. If I could just follow up, you know, I feel like the research findings that are important and that really do apply generally and could be used quite broadly and would be helpful are not at the level of something that's going to change tomorrow. In other words, we don't even have to be on the cutting edge. I mean, the research has accumulated over a period of time. There are a number of really interesting sort of important kinds of precepts that one could spell out that every program should apply to every program, and that people could use to evaluate programs or their own practices. And so this idea that if you had a curriculum that was based on, you know, this level of findings that are really important, I don't think it goes out of date tomorrow. We could improve it. We could find better methods for being more efficient or having kids absorb more from each sort of learning, you know, learning experience. But it's not that we know everything and that we've stopped studying them. It's just that there's a whole bunch of core things that really haven't been addressed that would make a huge amount of difference, and they're not going to go out of style. An example would be all the stuff that happens to the kid before they get to school, where I'm
okay. We can
I'm sorry. Oh gosh, please don't let me down, technology.
We can okay. Still hear you if in case you're hearing us.
Okay.
Maybe it's his AirPods.
Uh-oh. Well, Molly, do you want me to just keep talking about building a schedule?
Yes, I think people would love to have some concrete answers. What can you give us, Nell?
All right, good. So we don't departmentalize. We hope our school day is on the long side. And if it's not, we put that on our, you know, to-do list if we have any policy interest or, you know, or if we're an administrator. So then within that, a challenge I think that we face, and probably many of you have felt this, is that, you know, if you took every intervention study that's been done in every area of vocabulary and phonemic awareness and, you know, scientific inquiry and so forth, and you added them all up, you'd need, you know, like a 26-hour day to fit them all in. So you have a dilemma. How are you going to make the best possible use of the time that you have? So research doesn't give us like, this is the formula, this exact number of minutes, you know, we don't have that. You could do that study really hard, but you could randomly assign kids all over the country to different schedules and you could see who has, you know, the best long-term growth. But in the absence of that, what we do is kind of go with what seems like a good minimum in each area. So most people in the field, I think, talk about 45 minutes to 60 minutes a day of math. So let's set our piece on that. The National, the Council of Chief State School Officers Social Studies Collaborative is asking for 45 minutes a day of social studies with the little ones. Mm-hmm. And science, to my knowledge, hasn't made a similar pronouncement, but 45 minutes a day of science is, I think, would be, welcome by many people who are arguing there's not been enough science and social studies. Now, with science and social studies, there's a lot of...
I just want to make sure we're thinking, being specific about what the age range we're talking about here. That's early.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, good. Thank you. So I'm just right now, I'm really focused on K-3.
Yeah.
So for K-3, about an hour a day of math. And then with the science and social studies, 45 minutes a day each, or 90 minutes a day of one, and then 90 minutes, the next day, or you could do like a month of science and then a month of social studies or something, would be consistent with recommendations. Again, there's not science that says 45 minutes a day is the exact right number. And if you randomly assign kids to 60 minutes or 30 minutes or something, it will, cause a different outcome. So we just don't know that, but those are typical recommendations. What the science does tell us is that in science and social studies, we can fruitfully teach a lot of literacy. So there's quite a lot of research on that. And what we see in that research as a general trend is that when you're teaching literacy in the service of social studies or in the service of science, more of this research has been done in science and in social studies, that actually it doesn't harm either domain. It's a value added. It's like a synthesis, a sort of a synergy. That's what I mean, a synergy. So it's very important then what we're thinking about our school day, that we're not thinking that the only place we do literacy is in like the literacy block or the English language arts block, that we think of literacy as something we do throughout the day. Similarly with mathematics, there's actually good evidence, especially in preschool, actually. So Molly, you probably know this work well, where mathematics work with young children really boosts language development. It's a very good vehicle for children's oral language development. Mm-hmm. So instead of thinking of language and literacy as something we just do in this one little block, we want to think about our whole day and all of our opportunities to develop literacy across that whole day. But now we get to the big question. So how much time for literacy? Now, in the field, you see recommendations ranging from 90 minutes a day to 360 minutes a day. So that is a pretty wide range. 180, there are a number of programs right now that are in the 180 minutes a day range. And you're probably starting to think to yourself, I'm not sure how I would get 180 minutes a day of literacy with the math that you've just outlined and the science and the social studies. And we haven't talked about recess. There's quite a lot of research on recess. There's quite a lot of research on this. And it's very, very clear that more recess is actually better for learning. Go ahead, Mark. Yeah.
No, you're leaving out social emotional development and other things that people also want to work into the day. But the idea that literacy could be a part of other subjects, other areas, seems really great. How much coordination of that sort is required, and is that a change of thinking for most schools? I mean, it seems to require organization across classes. This is one of the things that I've seen in a different way, which is the kid is making progress one year using one curriculum or one approach or something, and then the next year they switch to something else, and there's a lot of relearning or unlearning or changing that goes on. If there had been more coordination from year to year, I understand you're talking about within, an age, particular year, but also across. Do you think this is a realistic thing? And do you think there'd be the same sort of enthusiasm for that as for, platooning or something like that? I mean, it sounds great. What needs to be done to figure out if it's how to do it well and whether it's effective?
Yeah, I mean, it's great question. So, I mean, the first thing is that honestly, in a lot of K-3 classrooms, there is no science and social studies instruction or very little going on of any kind. So we couldn't put literacy in it because there would be nothing to put the literacy in. And my YouTube channel does, or if you go to my website, nellkduke.org, if any of you are interested in this topic, there's a video where I try to make the argument of why we need science and social studies time for young kids and how that benefits literacy and so on. And so you could take a look at that. But anyway, So we do have approaches now that are out there. I hope I don't get this wrong. Well, it's the researched version is called Seeds of Science, Roots of Reading. Seeds of Science, Roots of Reading. It's a science instructional approach that was developed at the Lawrence Hall of Science at University of California, Berkeley. It's now a commercial program, and that's the name that I want to make sure I don't get wrong. So I'm just going to say, if you look up Seeds of Science, Roots of Reading, you'll get there. So that's an approach that integrates literacy and science, and research has found benefits for both literacy and science. So it's an example. There are certainly others. In my own work with my colleague Annalisa Halverson and other collaborators, we've developed social studies units. They're available free at my website in a project called Project Place that are, they're social studies, but they integrate some literacy. And in a randomized controlled trial in high poverty, low performing school districts, we found that using these units massively benefited social studies, but it also benefited informational reading. So again, you see where we get this synergy. But I see our time is short, and I don't want to miss the block that's devoted to literacy. So we've talked about the math, the science, the social studies, the recess. Social emotional learning should be throughout the day, but many research tested approaches to social emotional learning development also spend about 20 minutes that's focused on social emotional learning. So then with the time that we have for literacy, figuring out how to best use that, the research again hasn't, like, we haven't sort of randomly assigned kids to different distributions of the literacy block. But I think that most experts would say that kids need a really substantial chunk of that time to be focused on developing foundational skills. So that's developing their phonemic awareness, developing their understanding of phonics, but also applying that in fluency, developing their spelling, print concepts. So those underlying, I think most of the people on this call probably know what I'm talking about when I say foundational skills, but the foundational skills are really, really critical to develop. But what you don't want to do, and I know Mark agrees with this because we've talked about this very fact, you don't want to have like, I'm going to do 10 minutes of phonemic awareness. Now I'm going to do 20 minutes of phonics. Now I'm going to do 10 minutes of morphology. Now I'm going to do, 20 minutes of fluency. That's not how reading works. So if you look in Mark's book, he explains about bootstrapping. Tim Shanahan has a very nice blog post on reciprocity. It's a similar idea, but basically you don't cut up the literacy block into these tiny little pieces addressing these tiny little targets. What you want to do actually is create situations where you're simultaneously, for example, working on phonemic awareness and phonics, or where you're working on fluency, but it's giving you an opportunity to get that additional eyes on print so that kids get reinforcement. They've orthographically mapped the same words more times. So you really want to have that consideration when you're building the block. And then, of course, you want to make sure you're also teaching comprehension. And I say, of course, even though I totally get that for a lot of people, that's not an of course, but I will tell you that the research just isn't bearing out this idea that you spend kindergarten through second grade on foundational skills. And then when you hit third grade, start worrying about comprehension. That just isn't how reading works. So you want to be making sure that you're doing things like reading aloud and engaging in children in higher order discussion of text in kindergarten. Before kindergarten, but today, right now, we're just talking about K-3. So, in kindergarten, you want to make sure that you're doing that as well. And so the last thing I want to make sure I say about this before we go is I just want to talk more about differentiation, because I think the field, if you ask anybody in the field, what's the right number of minutes to spend on, say, foundational skills versus building knowledge and comprehension strategies and other comprehension? If someone gives you the same answer for all kids, then they're not aligned with the science.
Why would it be defined by the number of minutes as opposed to how long it takes actually a particular kid from a particular background at a particular point in development to get where you're supposed to be getting?
That's exactly right. So it's the answer to how many minutes is as long as it takes, right? And that's not going to be the same for kids, just as it, you know, for those of you who have more than one child at home, you can attest just from your own children that they didn't probably have, you know, the same profile of supports from you in their development. So there's good research that looks at differentiation. The late and great Carol Connor, who many of you may know from her work in scientific studies of reading or from lots of other things she's done, just did wonderful research where they varied based on assessment results. Some kids got more code-focused instruction, some kids got more meaning-focused instruction. And guess what? They did much better than if everybody got the same amount. There's a lovely meta-analysis. It's called something like differentiated literacy instruction. I know this part's right. Boondoggle or best practice. Boondoggle or best practice. You can look up that meta-analysis and it shares a lot of important information about the value of differentiating literacy instruction. And so, I know it's 4:05, so we have to wrap up. But anyway, differentiation, really important.
Can I ask a question about the differentiation? When you're talking differentiation, are you thinking like, so that's going to be small group work? Like logistically putting into these pieces of the literacy block, are there recommendations about whole group time versus small group time? What should your small group be doing when they're not working with you? Those kind of boots on the ground questions.
Yeah, I love those questions. So first of all, when I say differentiated, I do not mean by level or ability. So let's just clean that right out of our our ideas. So differentiation is really about, you know, grouping kids with knowledge of the profile of their strengths and needs. So putting kids together who have similar strengths and needs, which is going to vary very much from week to week and from kid to kid. Just knowing that we're talking about this flexible kind of grouping, sometimes you're grouping by interests. There's actually research support for that as well. So to be clear, that's what I mean by differentiation. At my website, there are some materials related to this. There's a section called the Listening to Reading, Watching While Writing Protocol, which is an informal assessment tool. It's meant to be an alternative to running records because I see running records as problematic. I'm trying to offer a different way or a different tool. Anyway, there's a video there where it talks about this idea of flexible grouping, needs-based grouping, strengths-based grouping. But in terms of time, a really interesting line of research that doesn't get a lot of attention for reasons I'm not sure about is a line of research where researchers look at highly effective schools compared to less effective schools. There's a little bit on highly effective districts compared to less effective districts. And then a long line of research on highly effective teachers versus more average teachers. And what researchers generally do is they have a way that they define who's more and less effective. So for example, they might give kids assessments at the end of the previous year and they figure out, well, which are the first grade teachers whose kids really were doing much better in writing and reading than everybody else. And then often what the teachers do is, or the researchers do is they go in and they watch the really effective teachers and they watch the other teachers. and then they try to figure out what are those really effective teachers doing that's different. Now you have to be careful with this kind of research because just because something is a difference doesn't mean it's the cause of the greater success of the one teacher than the other. So you have to be cautious, like Mark said earlier, for any kind of research, right? But anyway, when you go into these classrooms, you're able to see some things that are different. And one of the things that comes up study after study is that more effective teachers have kids in small groups more of the time. Less effective teachers tend to have kids in whole group more of the time. And I actually wrote this down to share with you today. This is from a book by researcher Barbara Taylor, formerly of the University of Minnesota. And in her most accomplished teachers spent 25 minutes on whole group and 48 minutes in small group, working with kids in small groups. The least accomplished teachers, it was the exact opposite, the exact inverse. They spent 48 minutes in whole group and 25 minutes in small groups. So I hope that that kind of speaks to your question, Molly, about just concretely, we're talking about a pretty large chunk of small group time where we differentiate so we meet the needs of as many learners as possible. One last point with that is that when we differentiate into our small group, we may spend a lot more time, you know, we may meet some kids every day for small group because that's what they need, right? There are other kids where we might see them more like 3 times a week for small group. So that's another way we can differentiate. It's not just what we're teaching, but it's also how often we're seeing the kids. And again, that may vary. You all know, I'm sure you've experienced this, where you give kids a little boost and they really take off. So then you're going to vary, you know, how much time you spend with them. Whereas other kids, you know, they're going to need that extra support for a lot longer. So I hope that's helpful, Molly.
I think that was a lot of really, really helpful and acute observations. I just wanted to follow up on a couple of them so that we don't lose them. One is this idea of like, if you teach things separately, like phonemic awareness, phonics, vocabulary, morphology, grammar, et cetera, you're missing something. You're doing violence to the way the language and writing system actually works, because these things are not actually independent. And what would make teaching effective is if when you're teaching one thing, you're actually conveying information to kids about other things as well. So if you're teaching about phonemes, the context of words, you're teaching about phonemes, but you're also giving them practice with that word. Or, and similarly for other kinds of things, all of these things, compare that with, well, I need to have a block that's only on this and then a block that's only on this. You're missing the places where they overlap. And that's where the really effective teaching, I think, is going to come from. And the kid is going to get the most out of the experience. My question is really whether we have instructional practices and materials, you know, oriented towards this way of thinking, because it's really, really crucial. And I see a lot of, we're going to have a block that's devoted to each of the 5 pillars of reading. Or we're going to have, you know, blocks that are devoted to decoding, and then blocks that are devoted to language. It's the exact opposite of this idea that you should be taking advantage of the ways in which these things fit together. So I guess one question is whether there's movement towards a teacher education and professional development and curricula and other support materials that really show people how to do this. I mean, or exemplify, well, what would this mean concretely? And as opposed to what we have now, I think, which is a lot of brute force teaching of things that could be, might have to, you know, we don't know the exact amounts to be teaching, and we're missing out on some efficiencies. So this reciprocity or interactivity, or, you know, dealing with the fact that the parts are related, is really something that I hope will be more widely recognized and more incorporated in instruction. The other thing is this idea that the kid goes through stages. So the kid has to master this to some level before we can move to this, before we can move to this, before we can move to this. That also is really built on an oversimplification. It treats things as though they are separate, and it treats things as though they develop in this kind of layered sort of fashion. Kids aren't on that kind of timetable. Kids are going as fast at their own paces to learn some of this and some of that. It's not that, for example, you would need to show that you understand everything there is to know about a rhyme before you could go on to start dealing with syllables or start dealing with phonemes, but you do see that being implemented in a variety of places. So when researchers talk about stages in reading and stuff, people should realize kids don't develop in stages. They are not literally going like this and then like this and then like this. In fact, it's all more gradual and it's all more overlapping. When we talk about stages, I don't talk about stages, but when people talk about stages, it's kind of to give you some broad differences that happen over time. It's not that you're strictly on a certain sort of sequence and you can't move on to something else until an earlier thing is mastered. So when I was talking before about sort of these general things that we know from developmental research, research on reading language and other areas, the idea of the redundancy, the way in which the structures overlap, and the fact that kids don't actually develop in stages with discreetly building the parts, those are two really rock solid things that are not going to suddenly change. And I can imagine how it would be really useful to have examples of materials that did this in a really effective way. So I'm all for it. I just don't know what the state of the, we need more of it, and we need to make it possible for teachers and the people who teach teachers and everybody who's interested to get a sense of what this involves. It would really help a lot.
I totally agree, Mark. And I want to give just to close two examples. I agree there's lots more to be done, and especially lots more to be done about curriculum materials that do this kind of work for us. But one example that I would like to share, and I saw somebody pop, I can't totally follow the chat, but I was able to see somebody pop in, what about writing? So there's actually a lovely meta-analysis that came out not too long ago. Steve Graham was of course involved. He's like the king of king of meta-analyses in writing. And it looked at approaches in which no more than 60% of the time was devoted to either reading or writing. So where the instruction was really giving pretty near equal value and attention to reading and writing, often in an integrated fashion. And the results look very, very nice for that kind of approach. And so the reciprocity between reading and writing, between spelling a word and learning to read that word, between handwriting that word and being able to read that word, between composing a text of a certain genre and being able to comprehend a text of a certain genre. I mean, those reciprocities are really lovely. And so that's an area where I think if you, for example, go to the What Works Clearinghouse Practice Guide on Developing Effective Elementary Writers, that practice guide has some nice examples of where you're including the reading and the writing. So that's one. The second one I wanted to offer, mainly because I understand it's being attacked in the science of reading, some science of reading groups, so is an approach called interactive writing. This is an approach I understand some people are saying is whole language. I'm not, this is very, very odd conclusion about this approach, since it works quite a bit on phonemic awareness and, you know, letter sound associations and print conventions, but for whatever reason, apparently some people think it's whole language. But to be clear, it's a specific instructional technique. It's been tested in numerous randomized control trials. So you randomly assign a child or children to either have interactive writing or not. Interactive writing does very well. These studies have been done in preschool, kindergarten, first grade. So, you know, across at least that span. And in interactive writing, what teachers are doing is leading children through a series of steps that basically has them applying and developing phonemic awareness, phonics, print concepts simultaneously. It certainly wouldn't be your whole program. I mean, you would do it maybe 10 minutes a day along with, you know, your more explicit systematic instruction in phonics, for example. But as a piece of the pie, it does a nice job of kind of working on these reciprocities. There's a fair amount of information about it out there that's not necessarily so tightly aligned to research. But if you'd like some tightly aligned to research information about it, the REL West, Regional Educational Lab West, has a nice video that has Steve Graham in it and myself on interactive writing. You can learn more about it probably from somewhere on my website. But anyway, it's just an example of what Mark's talking about around techniques that really are reciprocal in nature.
Yes, yeah, so I don't know those programs in particular, and would look at them, and we'll look at them very, very, we'll look at them. There is independent research, it's not about those particular programs, that talks about the differences between learning from sort of comprehension versus learning from producing things. So a lot of this is done in speech, where you can learn something from hearing someone, or you can learn it from having to articulate something yourself, you know, hearing the answer versus having to produce it. Same thing happens in reading. You can read the thing and then but you can, and then be asked about it and tested on whether you are the master of something. But there's also, do you have to actually write out what you learned or answer questions or do things more actively to produce the act of actually having to produce the answer rather than being told it or rather than being led into it is really, there's now a really good research literature on this. The production part, which is in reading and writing, it's the writing part. And in speech, it's the speaking part, actually is has some very special properties in terms of how much you learn from the experience. So in, for example, spoken language, it says that, you know, there's a view of bilingual second language learning in adults, which says minimize the amount that the kid speaks because they're going to make errors. But what the research is saying is the exact opposite, which is that the producing of the utterance has demands that really allow you to learn much more from it. And if you make an error, the error is itself a learning opportunity. So I don't doubt that, Steve, although I don't, we don't have no kings around here, but writing and integrating it, there's even more writing is important of itself, but there's also now more research suggesting that the having to produce the sort of sentences, answers, other things generatively, it has a effect on learning that like learning the content that goes beyond what you would get from just reading it and answering a question later. So hopefully there'll be more materials of these sorts. We could all look at them and try them out and get data on them. And it says there are suggestions for the path forward here. And we don't want to neglect them, right? It's not as though we don't have things that we can build on. And to me, that's the message about the science of reading. There is stuff to build on here, and we're gonna try to do that.
Yes. Well, I know we're out of time, but
I've made people wait. Don't you hate it when people give talks and they go over and go, okay, when is gonna be done?
I know. I was gonna say, and not to invite myself over, but if you were ever to have me back, I'd love to get into now what actually are we gonna do during these precious minutes? You know, we didn't get as much into the actual practices as I'd love to, but I know we need to let people go. Thanks so much, both of you, for inviting me to have this conversation. Oh. And thank you to all the people who are joining us on this Sunday afternoon or who are listening to the recording later. Really appreciate all the hard work you're doing to make science be an important influence on your practice.
Here. So we'll have you back next week, and now you're just really a pleasure to talk to and interact with, and your command of so many areas is really just so helpful, and we can talk about meta-analyses another time. No, I mean,
that'll be fun. But I just want everyone to notice that this is how scientists
agree.
You know, he shares a study and a point, and then I share a study and a point. We say, I don't know if we agree on that. Well, what about this? And we do it in a friendly and kind way.
And you adjust your views because you're taking everything you're taking everything seriously.
That's what you should see. So I just hope that you don't get it. You're not thinking that Twitter or these vitriolic discussions on Facebook, that's not how most scientists engage in the work. And that's not what's going to serve our children best. So Mark and I will continue to sometimes disagree and often agree, and we'll do it in a kind and supportive way, hopefully.
Thank you, Nell, for inundating us with resources. I'm going to have to put together an enormous document to link all your papers and videos and everything that you've recommended for us today. So I really appreciate
you've
that.
You've probably made a lot of fans. Thank you. Thank you so much. And we'll talk again, okay?
Sounds great. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Bye, everybody. Thanks.
Bye, everyone.
Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for listening to this reading meeting recording. You can find more information about past and future reading meetings on our website. We hope you'll join us for future meetings.